trouble. The White House chief advisor on Homeland Security and terrorism has resigned. Fran Townsend serving in the position for more than 4 years. Martial law continues across Pakistan as President General Pervez Musharraf rejects Western demands to restore democratic rule before national elections early next year. In Cambodia, the former Khmer Rouge head of state arrested to stand trial for genocide, the fifth high official of Pol Pot to be charged. More than 2 million people died during the killing fields regime. Former Republican Governor Jim Gilmore will seek the U.S. Senate seat currently held by John Warner, who is retiring. Gilmore may face another governor, Democrat Mark Warner, but he has to win the primary first before doing that. And former Atlanta Falcons quarterback Michael Vick, turning himself into authorities, begins serving up to 18 months in prison. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Did you know 1 billion adults around the world cannot read? Two-thirds are women, many prohibited from learning. The rate of illiteracy is declining, but the number who can't read has been increasing. These are more than just numbers, they're people. They're your friends, neighbors, and even your family. Consider these numbers. In America, if you didn't speak English in your home, you're 44% more likely to be reading below the most basic level. If you didn't complete high school, the chances are good that you can't read. 85% of prisoners are illiterate, as are the kids who wind up in juvenile court. Here are the facts. If you can read, you can learn, get a better job, and make more money. If you can't read, you can't learn, you can't find a good job, you can't make a decent living. Choose smart. Learn to read. If you're out of school, find a literacy program through your local library.
This message on literacy has been brought to you as a public service by the Quality News Network. For more information, please contact your local library.
The Japanese whaling fleet today steamed out of harbor on its way to hunt humpback whales in Antarctica, despite warnings from Western allies. Japan says it will kill about 1,000 whales. The country is using a loophole in the global moratorium that allows lethal research. Whale meat is a prized menu item in Japan. Activists report up to 80% of electronics recycled by Americans are then sent overseas to fuel a global trade that ultimately endangers both the environment and poverty-stricken workers. E-waste is often brokered by Chinese-owned companies to countries in Asia and Africa. Food banks and soup kitchens nationwide are reporting an unprecedented scarcity of donations. Many groups say they're canceling Thanksgiving dinners and food baskets, more working families in need than ever before. America's number two home improvement retailer, Lowe's, posting a 10% decline in quarterly earnings and lowering its annual forecast. Food company J.M. Smucker posting higher than expected quarterly profits, boosted by price hikes and the acquisition of Eagle Condensed Milk. Price of gas jumping 13 cents a gallon in the past 2 weeks, that's according to the Lundberg Survey. At today's close of Wall Street, the Dow plunging 218 points to close at 12,958, NASDAQ down 44, S&P 500 down 25. More at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
Get around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
I had to, you know, people said, well, you have to redefine it.
We had a slow start, so we're going to go away to get in the music industry.
Well, it was also my way of paying the rent as well, because, you know, I moved to New York City from art school in Connecticut, and you move to the city, you gotta get an apartment, you gotta pay the rent while you're running around to all the A&R people with the songs and trying to get a record deal. So it was what I loved to do. It was what I was doing at the time, and I was fortunate enough to get a good job and in the music industry, working for a lot of wonderful, famous people, and having a very exciting time with my art direction, graphic design work, as well as looking for a record deal. And then when I found the record deal, you know, then I started making the records, and I stopped doing the art direction for a period of time. So But it was like anybody else, you know. So I, instead of becoming a waiter or something like that, I was an art director.
Well, it was very clever, and apparently you were quite good at it. You received Paul Revere Awards, and that's no simple thing to do. And, you know, working with John Lennon and Bruce Springsteen.
Something I loved, you know, and when I stopped recording in the early 80s, I had to, you know, people say, well, you had to redefine yourself. And I said, no, really. I mean, it was a difficult transition period for me going from recording and performing and that whole thing back to, you know, being a civilian, so to speak. But I really didn't have to redefine myself too much because I had always done art direction and design. And when I, when my whole deal with Casablanca Records and the whole disco thing fell, you know, bottomed out, well, once again, you have to go back and you have to pay the rent. And I was fortunate enough to get a job with Warner Brothers Music in the print division. And I went right back into what I had been doing before I made cathedrals. So, it was an easy transition on one level, but it was very difficult psychologically. I mean, I was a mess. It was very difficult to going to being a recording celebrity to going back and being a civilian, you know. It's a rough transition to make. I see a lot of people. I was fortunate that I was able to do it. A lot of people don't do it, you know. They end up drug addicts or hopeless alcoholics or suicidal or whatever, you know.
Cathedrals, though, was huge.
I was going to say, I sympathize with these kids who, especially with these rappers, who, you know, they make a CD and it drops double platinum or triple platinum, and the second CD is only platinum, and the third CD, they're back on the block selling crack, you know, and people don't have any, they pretty much don't have regard for these kids, and I sympathize with them because it's very difficult to live one life and then have to you know, like come down to a different kind of reality when the success is no longer working for you and you spent all your money and, oh please, it's a depressing time. But let's move on. So I was lucky. I was fortunate. I got a job right away when I moved to the city, and then when I stopped recording, I just picked up where I left off.
Well, the track Cathedrals came out in 76, and apparently. Well, as I know, and you know, and anybody who was DJing around that time knows, it was huge. In fact, Cashbox referred to Cathedrals is to disco what Blue Suede Shoes was to rock and dance halls. Cathedrals is an amazing track. Could you tell us about the background on that? Was that your very first attempt?
Well, no, I had knocked around the music business for a while, and I had done several other recordings, pop recordings. And I came up with Cathedrals. I had done a disco tune, kind of like a tongue-in-cheek disco tune as D.C. LaRue for Claridge Records called Moving Closer. And it wasn't an incredibly successful hit, but I loved the record, and if anybody can find it, they're lucky, but it's really a terrific little tune. And then Cathedrals, very, you know, I was living in New York City, and it's just, you know, it's a... I was going to the discos and I was dancing, you know, and I was a part of the whole revolution and everything with music, and I was going to all the underground clubs, and I remember I was at the David Mancuso's loft on 99 Prince Street here in 1975, and I was with Steve DiCristo and Vince Aletti, and I remember that it really was like a religious kind of communal experience with the drugs and the music and the whole thing. And I can remember Steve DiCristo threw his hands up in the air and he said, oh, discos are the cathedrals of now, you know. And I said, oh my goodness, what a good idea, what a good idea for a concept album. And I was I had a fixation on the Donna Summer recording, Love to Love You Baby, and I felt it was a great venue for, you know, these long kind of conceptual albums that could make a statement and on, you know. And I felt that I went home and I just came up with the idea of Cathedrals from that one moment at the loft. And I felt, it was pretty, I could talk about what was happening, and I felt very free to talk about the sexuality and about the music and about the nightlife and about the drugs and about the whole thing. So that's what I did, you know, and I put it together. I took it around. like it wasn't my, to answer your question, it wasn't my first stab at making records. It really wasn't, but it was the right recording for the right time, it was the right moment, and everything seemed to work, and it was saying all the right things, and it was, when the record came out, it was amazing. It was just an immediate success in the club, which was where it was supposed to be a success. I never made a top 40 commercial record. In retrospect, I should have, I guess, you know, but I never did. I never went into the studio to make one of those little cutesy putsy shake your booty things like Casey and the Sunshine Band or Village People or even Donna Summer. I mean, I was never A&R'd in that. I mean, I always went in to make serious musical statements. You know, yes, forgive me. And like I said, it was very successful, and it was a landmark record, and it changed a lot of music. It was a very progressive record for its time.
Well, I understand
lyrically and musically, and with the bass line and with the rhythms of the whole thing. I remember back in the day that, you know, I could not get radio play with it because of the lyric, and because I thought the lyric was too sexually outrageous. And I listen to the lyrics now, you know, and you get little Kim singing "Eat My Pussy Right," and I said, well, you know, I can't believe, you know, that. And I listen to the lyrics of Cathedrals. I can't believe that they wouldn't play it, but they didn't, you know, especially on U.S. radio. I got airplay in Europe, but they didn't understand what I was saying because it was all in English, and you know, they spoke French or Italian or whatever.
When it did hit in mid 76, apparently it went to a top 10 dance record on the entire world. And what's this about it being re-released in England and remixed as if it's a new record? What's going on with that?
Well, yeah, that's great stuff. I mean, they had this is really an amazing. I think it speaks a lot for the track. About a year and a half, 2 years ago, a producer called Bobby Blanco and Mickey Moto. They sampled Cathedrals, and they reconstructed, they re-EQ'd it, and added some bottom and a little bit of a rap thing, and they called it 3 a.m., and they released it, and it was a huge hit. It was a huge hit. But all it is Cathedrals. It's all it is the track Cathedrals. So much so that my music publishing company got me a writer's rate on it. It's not a sample rate. I get paid as a writer and a performer because it's pretty much Cathedrals. And it's pretty much, it was a huge hit, and it's a 35-year-old record. You know, it sounds a little bit better because they re-EQ'd it and they added some bottom, but in essence, it's a record that's 35 years old. Then there's another DJ in England, his name is Greg Wilson, and he did an edit of Cathedrals. Once again, one of these a very creative edit of the instrumental track, and they released it on a CD called Deep Down and Discofied, which has been in the English Top 50 now for like 7 months, and that has, once again, and that's a big hit. Now, it's unbelievable, that's a 35-year-old record. Now, it's re-edited and very creatively done, but in essence, it's Cathedrals. It's a 35-year-old record. So that being said, the Defected Records over there in England, the guy over there, he said, listen, he said, this record, this is amazing, it's such an amazing record that we would like. So they've gone to EMI, who has the original master tapes, and they've licensed the original analog master, and they're making they're doing digital copies of it, and they've got three or four disc jockeys, and they're going in and they're going to remix the record and re-release it as if it were a brand new record, because everybody, and it's wild, because I don't think this has ever been done in the history of the annals of history of music. It's just a really wild, wonderful, fortunate thing that's happened with the record. It's amazing, and it only proves to me that it really was ahead of its time. It really was a groundbreaking record. When the record can come back after 35 years and be received like it was a brand new record, it's just, it's really out of sight. I mean, it's very unique. What can I say?
Well, as our friend Glenn Rivera in California points out, it seems that some of the younger DJs are beginning to do their research and rediscover at least people like yourselves and some of the early pioneers. Was this the particular track that you took to Tom Moulton that Tom Moulton just didn't get?
No, that's an interesting story. I think I told that to Glenn. I was in California, and I had done Cathedrals and the T-Dance and Confessions. And the guy who was producing me at the time for Casablanca, his name was Bob Esty, and we were locking horns on a lot of creative stuff. I didn't get along with him very well, and so I said, well, gee, maybe I can find somebody else to produce me. So I had made a couple of calls, one to Bob Crewe, who had done Hollywood Hot and a couple of other things with Monty Rock III and Get Dancing or whatever. And then I had called up Tom Moulton, and he was out there doing some work. And I said, Tom, I'm looking for somebody to produce my next album, which turned out to be Forces of the Night, which is my least favorite album. I mean, for whatever reason. And I said to Tom, I said, you know, I'm looking for somebody to produce me. And he said to me, he said, well, DC, he said, I love your music. He said, no disrespect, he said, but he said, I'm a disco producer. And he said, I produce disco records. And he said, I'll be damned if I know what kind of music you make. He said, because I certainly wouldn't qualify as disco. And he said, I would be the least appropriate man to come in and produce your next album. And I thought that was, you know, I said, oh, okay. You know, so, but because I all along, if you really listen to my music, it was never disco as, it never fell into that, you know, like formula kind of disco stuff. It was always different in one way or the other, so it really couldn't be bagged as you know, just pure disco stuff, you know. So that was what Tom said. Tom didn't know, but so eventually, I ended up making Forces of the Night with Bob Esty, and I was really unhappy with it. It didn't turn out the way I heard it in my head. At that point in time, his ego was overwhelmingly difficult and out of control. He had just done the Donna Summer stuff. Once Upon a Time, and then he had done this thing, Last Dance, and he had won an Academy Award with that. And then he had produced Barbra Streisand's Enough Is Enough, Main Event, and then he did Enough Is Enough, and you couldn't talk to him anymore. And when I went in to the studio to do my recording, I pretty much knew what I wanted to happen. I knew what I wanted to hear as an end result. I couldn't talk to him anymore. I mean, he was just like a little Nazi Hitler person, and he wouldn't take direction, he wouldn't take my advice. And when I remember on one of the tracks, Hot Jungle Jumps and Voodoo Rhythm, we had done a great rhythm track, and I wanted to keep it very sparse and jungle-like. And he added these horns and these strings and these throats and this, and I said, Bob, this is just like a long record. This is not what I hear in my head. And it didn't matter. He just did it. He went in and did what he wanted anyway. And the final analysis, that Hot Jungle Jumps was a big hit. And a lot of people love it. You know, but every time I hear it, I realize it's not the record that I wanted it to be. And I'm very unhappy with it still after all these years. But go on.
Well, Hot Jungle Drums and Voodoo Rhythms, I believe, is a part of the Forces of the Night LP, if I'm not mistaken. That's right?
Yeah, that's right. Right.
And you say it's not your favorite album. Is that really confined to just Hot Jungle Drums? Because I have to be perfectly honest with you. I think the track, the tracks as they are assembled, Forces of the Night, that particular cut is just to die for. I just really like it.
Well, you know what? I'm glad. I'm glad that you love it. You know, what can I say? It's like, it's not my favorite. But I think that, you know, I've gotten used to it. To be honest, I went for a long time doing other things with my life, and I hadn't really sat down to listen to any of my old recordings for about 10 years, believe it or not. And just recently, I put up a website, a fan site, www.dclarue.org. And it's like a little nostalgia website for my fans out there. And you can purchase my albums, you know, if you want to go to the website, you want to hear some of the stuff that I did. It's all been digitally remastered, and you can purchase all the albums, number 5 albums and the compilations and whatever. And so when the digital remastering was done, I brought everything home to my living room here, and I And I listened to, believe me, I listened to these recordings for the first time in a long time. Because it was my job to listen to them. I had always been a boy. I wasn't one to live in the past, and I didn't care, and I didn't want to hear them. And it's like, that was behind me. That was then. This is now. And so I sat down, and I listened to all the albums, all five albums, from beginning to end, and in sequence as I recorded them. And, Peter, I'll tell you something. I remember really hating Forces of the Night. And as I listened to it a couple of months ago, I don't hate it so much. And it's funny because I was listening to it and I said, why did I hate this so much? You know, because it's not bad. It wasn't bad. And I'll tell you, there's a tune on the second side called Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, which I said, gee, this really does sound nice. You know, it's better than I remember it. And so it does have its saving grace. So, you know, I guess you're not so far off by, like, looking at it.
Well, I think one of the things I liked about Forces of the Night so much was the sudden kick in of the Latin influence. I thought it was genius.
Well, thank you. The whole concept of that album is On Come the Forces of the Night, and that Latin thing was about a hooker who had a white boyfriend who just she wanted to get rid of while she was turning a trick, you know, and it was a Spanish hooker, you know, so it was like and I love that transition too, where that drum comes in, boom, with the rice on the drums and the Latin horn thing starts. It's a nice change.
Yes, it is.
And like I said, I remember disliking it a lot more than I dislike. I think now it has its merits. Some things, and I know the part that exactly the part that you're talking about, because when I was listening to it a couple of months ago, when I was got all these digital remasters, I said, ooh, that's nice. You know, that segue is really nice because they go boom, dun, da, 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 da. It really is.
Well, I have a question. It's based on something written by Saturday Night Forever, the story of disco. They're remarking on your track, I'll Wake Up Screaming in the Middle of the Night, and says that's the message is about anxiety attacks. Okay, I get that. I can follow that. But then it says that Forces of the Night is a mega paranoia cut. And I listen to it, and I don't get it. What is the paranoia there?
You know, once again, it's all subjective. And I didn't get that either. You know, but, you know, it's like... it's whatever it means to you. I found that, and you don't try to analyze these things. If you listen to it and hear one thing, and if Juicy, who's the guy who wrote that book, listens to it and hears another thing, you know, everybody has the right to their own interpretation of the song. It's like with cathedrals. If you were gay, you heard it and you interpreted that lyric as a gay lyric. And very much so, and that's granted. But that being said, if it was a big straight hit as well in the underground clubs, and if you were straight, you heard it and you interpreted it as a heterosexual lyric. It was whatever you wanted to hear in it. I always perceived it as the musical front runner to that Diane Keaton film, Looking for Mr. Goodbar. You know, mm-hmm. Because it was about sexuality at that time in the club, and you could be a female looking for a one night stand with a guy, you could be a guy looking for a one night stand with a female, you could be a female looking for a female, or a male looking for a male. It was whatever you were and how you perceived the lyric, and that paranoia thing. I didn't understand that either about the Forces of the Night track, but if he saw it that way, then. But I Wake Up Screaming is quite a paranoid song. It really is, you know. It's like, so he was right about that, and we both understand that conceptually. But I didn't get what he was talking about either. But I'm not going to argue with him, you know. It's however.
Well, I was just going to say we should go back to cathedrals. I believe because many of our listeners or perhaps haven't heard it. We have a large number of straight listeners, in addition to our LGBT audience, who we inherit the straight listeners from Bob Kincaid's show, which runs just prior to this, and we're glad to have them. They're sympathetic to the gay folks, but they don't necessarily understand us completely. That's one of the purposes of the show, is to burst those stereotypes, and we have a large number of LGBT folks who who join us at 9 p.m., and I suspect many of them don't recall it off the top of their heads. There's another influence I've read about regarding cathedrals, and that was you had just broken up with a girlfriend at the time, and you were a little bit miffed at the club scene. Is that true?
Well, I you know, with my sexuality, I mean, I don't want to get too heavy into it, but I, you know, my sexuality is pretty much the individual, and I've had relationships with women and men, and at the time I was experiencing a very bad thing with this girl Roxy, who was very promiscuous. She worked at Atlantic Records, and like I said, the sexuality, my sexuality was years ago, I used to be very facetious and say it was trisexual. I would try anything sexual at least three times, you know. I don't like to be locked into any one thing, because it's really the individual. It has always, in my life, it has always been the individual, and whether it's the individual male or the individual female, and the situation, you know. I mean, I'm just that way. I mean, and I've never felt that I would have to, that I had to define myself as any one thing. When I was in high school, I had a steady girlfriend and a steady boyfriend in the same high school, and it never bothered me for a minute. You know, it never did, and I never thought about it. I never went through that whole pang of anxiety or self analysis or whatever. It just seemed so natural, and it just that's how I've always lived my life, you know.
Well, you know, that falls right in line with some of our other bisexual listeners, that it is about the person, and I think you summed that up very well.
Peter, I don't want to go to my sex life now because it's real dull, but even if something comes along now, it's still about the individual, you know, and the connection you make with the human being, and it's just always been that way for me. You know, it really has been. And my partners have been that way too. My sexual partners have been, you know, I always say all my boyfriends have girlfriends and babies, and all my girlfriends have girlfriends and boyfriends, and you know, it's always been like that in my life. You know, it's never been one. I've never been locked into any one sexual thing. I think my music lyrically reflects that. You know, if you listen carefully, you know, I was during those years. I mean, I was so honest about my emotions and about how I perceive things and about my sexuality. It was no bullshit. It was no holds bars. And I really gave everything. I put everything on the line, and I said everything I was feeling. And if you listen to the lyrics of my songs, you can see it, you know. And if you hear bisexuality there, because it was there. And I mean, there was one song called Dancing with Strangers was a song about me and May Tang, and it happened to be a woman, but then there are other songs that reflect my male attraction, you know. So it's and I think that's, I'm happy that there's a tremendous reinterest in my music. It's not just, you know, I've never experienced it like I've experienced it in the last year and a half, 2 years. Over the last 35 years, I'm really honest. I mean, about 10 years ago, Rhino released a whole bunch of disco dance compilations, you know, that included Cathedrals and Overture and this and that. And then the Casablanca box set came out with Let Them Dance. And there was a slight, you know, bleep on the screen for me. There was a slight reinterest, but people were a little bit interested in my stuff. And I saw my airplay, royalty, with ASCAP go up a little bit, and I saw the mechanicals from the publishing go up a little bit, but nothing like it's been the last 2 years, Peter, and it's out of nowhere. I think it's because of the internet, and I think there's a real connection there, and I think it's a lot of young people. And one thing I'll share about the website, I'll mention the website again because I'm trying to sell some CDs here. It's dclarue.org. I hope you don't mind me giving it a plug.
No, I certainly don't. And in fact, we are posting it in the chat room.
I get a lot of email. When you come into the website right away, it says, and I answer it all personally, you know, dclarue@dclarue.org. I get so much fan mail from kids. And I'm, this is no disrespect. I mean, if I get fan mail from people in Barcelona, and at the end they'll say, they're 22 years old. They're 17 years old. I get fan mail from Brazil from guys who are 25. You know, and when I put the website up, I was thinking, gee, you know, I'm a bunch of old disco queens, from the 70s, tired old disco queens, and they'll be, they're all 100 years old. And I'm not being disrespectful, but you know what I mean. And it turns out that I'm getting these things. I get email from England from these guys in Manchester, and they say 18 years old, 19 years old. And I don't know where it's coming from. And I get lots of fan mail. I get fan mail from Sweden. And I got fan mail from Siberia. And how these people have gotten so interested in my music and so interested in 35-year-old stuff. It's been an amazing last couple of years. It was an amazing journey here because with all my honesty in my heart, I never for a minute ever thought I would see this kind of interest again. It's just like this thing happening in England with this remastering and the remixing of Cathedrals like it was a new record. This has never happened.
Well, I think it's well-deserved, and I think what we ought to do, if you don't mind, is break for just a minute, and let's run Cathedrals. The version that I have is not the remastered version from England. I believe this is the original version, and I'm sure the people would love to hear it. And when I came in as the intro to the show, I believe I neglected to give out our telephone numbers if you'd like to call in and talk with myself and D.C. LaRue. By the way, what does D.C. stand for?
David Charles.
David Charles, you'd like to call it and talk.
David Charles.
David Charles. The telephone number is a toll-free 877, the number 4 head-on. That's 877, the number 4 head-on, which translates into 877-443-2366. Or if you have an unlimited long-distance calling plan, please use that. You'll save the studio a nickel or a buck. That number is 304-658-3333, and it rings in West Virginia. If you'd rather contact us by email, email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I do try to check the mail during the breaks. And again, we're about to run the Cathedrals track, which has suddenly been released, remastered and released in England as being, apparently it's huge. This is his first breakthrough, although he apparently had tried to do some others. This is the track that everybody remembers him for. Now, we have lots of other music. This is by no means the only track, but I'd like to run it now. It's called Cathedrals, D.C. LaRue. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think our listeners can now understand how DC LeRoux was the first white male ever to hold the number one R&B soul chart position in England. DC, that is an amazing blend of funk and disco. It has the violins. It has the funk rhythms. In fact, our production, the fellow in production says, that's not disco, that's funk. And then the violins, he goes, oh, that's disco. It's such an eclectic.
That's what I was saying earlier. I mean, my music really, it's like Tom Holton said, I don't know what your music is. It's certainly not disco. I don't know what it is. that mix, what is that, the disco net mix?
Actually, that mix was sent to me directly by our friend Glenn Rivera, and I don't have anything but the name and the title.
I think I've talked to Glenn because I think that's not the mix, or it's not the album mix. I think that's the disco net mix that was done a few years later. That they went in, they remixed for Disconet, one of that subscription service.
Oh, sure, I talk about it all the time.
That mix that you've just played, the strings that were taken out of the initial record, the first mix were added to the mix and then they extended the break. It's a pretty good mix, though. I mean, I haven't heard that one in a long time, but that's a very special mix. What can I say?
Disconet is amazing.
It's a big hit.
Yeah. Yes, I've always loved Disconet. And Glenn has an extensive Disconet collection, so it is very likely a Disconet remix. We'll have to check with him on that later.
One of the few authorized remixes, I think, is what you just played.
I see.
It worked, though. It was nice. It was good to hear it again. I haven't heard that in a long time.
It was a great track. And I regarding the funk beat to that, I have to point out that as time went by, you did another track called Indiscreet that a rapper who is the Grandmaster Flash is quoted as saying, it was the first hip-hop break I ever heard, and it started all of the hip-hop and rap beats to come. And that was in 1976.
It was released as a limited edition 12-inch, and then there was a bootleg released on Delight on the B-side of another black disco group, and Delight was a black label, and then that was so successful in the black clubs that it came out on a compilation called The Original Beats and Breaks Volume 1, and it was used, everybody has sampled those hip hop beats, from Curtis Blow to Beastie Boys to Puff Daddy to Mary J. Blige, I mean, on and on and on. And it's interesting because there was a disc jockey here in New York City on Hot 97, Red Alert, DJ Red Alert. And I have to watch my battery on my cell phone, though. I hope it doesn't go out. We're spending an awful lot of time. I hope it just doesn't go dead. I'm crossing my fingers. If it goes dead, Peter, it means that I haven't got any more juice left in my battery. I didn't think this would go on this long, this interview. But
we can go on forever.
But DJ Red Alert, this is interesting because we're doing a gay, lesbian, whatever show. DJ Red Alert had a beat and break show every Friday when he was on Hot 97. Now, in New York City here, Hot 97 was, and I think it was like the number one or number two black hip-hop rap station. And he's a black DJ. And he would play on Friday, an hour from 12 to 1 o'clock, all the original beats and breaks from all those first dance records back in the 70s that evolved, that the hip-hop people used to rap over to create their beats and breaks for, the evolution of what was turning into rap and hip-hop. He would always play Indiscreet. Indiscreet was one of the first four or five records that started that hip-hop break thing. It was a landmark record. And I had run into a DJ Red Alert on 125th Street here in Harlem about 4 years ago. And I said to him, I said, and he came over and I said, hi, it's me, DC. And he's, oh, DC, the room, blah, blah, blah. And they were in the middle of Harlem on 125th Street. And this is a true story, and I'm with a friend of mine, and And we're talking, and he said, oh, he said, you know, indiscreet. And I said, I can't thank you enough. I said, because on Friday I could be walking through Washington Square Park here in New York City, and these young black kids have on their radio, and I'm hearing indiscreet. And I said, you're terrific. You play it like every other Friday, and I'm so proud to be included as, you know, how you feel like an instrumental record in the evolution of hip-hop and rap. And I said, someday I would love to be able to walk down at some hip-hop award ceremony with Mary J. Blige as the grandfather of hip-hop. And he looked at me and he said, what, are you out of your mind? And I said, what do you mean? He said, you're white. And I said, oh, yeah, what? And he said, you're white. And he said, you know, and I hate to say it, he said, but, you know, and the hip-hop community is so anti-white and homophobic. He said, DC, he said, you better get real. He said, you're never going to be acknowledged as a major contributor to hip-hop simply because they're so homophobic and they're so anti-white. And that's coming from his very lips. And I think that it's an interesting comment because the record was picked up because it was bootlegged on a black label, and then it was included in a black compilation of beats and breaks. And everybody assumed that DC LaRue, because it was a black artist, And with all the records and with all that industry has been sampled and used on, all the hip hop and all the rap records, that you go to a book in on hip hop and the evolution of hip hop and the roots of hip hop, and I'm never acknowledged. Never acknowledged. And Red Alert said to me, don't expect to get acknowledged either. He said, because that's the way it goes, and you're never going to walk down the stage with Mary J. Blige and be acknowledged as any kind of hip-hop contributor, he said, because of what you are. And I think that's a real a statement of reverse discrimination, and I think it's real unfair. So there, I said it.
Well, I'm glad you did say it, and that's what this show is for. Let me point out now that if for any reason we should lose you early because the phone goes dead, may we continue it Wednesday evening? Because there's no guest schedule Wednesday. And in D.C., there's so much to talk about. You've been in movies. God knows how many stars you've met. We want to hear the star story. Sharon Redd, for crying out loud.
Star stories. Well, I guess we can always talk about it. Have you got any more questions that you feel are, you know, burning desire questions?
Mostly comments about your music. I would like to run some more tracks. I'm hesitant to run Forces of the Night because it runs 20 minutes, and I don't want to use up.
Well, you know, you can do that after we hang up, okay? Because, you know, you can play as much as you want after. Let's not waste the minutes, my battery time on playing my music, because you can always do that for a conversation.
We can always do that later. But if we, for any reason we lose you, we'd love to have you back Wednesday if that's possible. We can arrange that tomorrow.
We can talk about it tomorrow. You can email me. I don't think there'd be a problem at all. Not really.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, the thing about Cathedrals is not only it was the first commercially available 12-inch 45 single in the U.S., and I haven't told them this yet, but it was the first 12-inch single to ever be charted on Billboard magazine before or after.
And everybody, they think they know. Pete Travers had a record called Heaven Must Be Missing an Angel. You know, remember that tune?
Sure.
Okay, well, and everybody assumes that that was the first commercially available 12-inch because it was so much, it was a big commercial hit. I mean, that went, they had a 7-inch 45 and it went top 10 on top 40 radio. Whereas Cathedrals always remained an underground record and it never had a little 45 and it was never edited down to 3 minutes. So people assume that the first commercially available 12-inch was Tavares and Heaven Must Be Missing an Angel, but it wasn't. It was Cathedrals. And I think if Cathedrals had been a bigger hit, they would have been the acknowledgement. And then Cathedrals wasn't enough of a hit, though, and because it did precede Tavares and as a commercial 12-inch. And when it hit the Billboard Top 100 as a 12-inch 45, the people at Billboard didn't know what the hell to do, and they were very confused and scratching their head, and they said, this can't be, because this top 100 is for 7-inch 45 records, and this is a 12-inch 45 remix, and this is like, it doesn't belong here. And so because of Cathedrals making the top 100 charts on Billboard as a 12-inch 45, Billboard turned around 2 weeks later and created the dance chart, the 12-inch dance chart. And so Cathedrals went from being in the top 100 as a 12-inch 45 commercially available to, like, top 10 on the dance chart. And they created the whole special dance chart because they didn't know how to handle 12-inch 45s on their top 100 because they didn't feel it belonged there. They didn't feel 12-inch 45s belonged there.
Well, DC, how do you feel about the recording industry and this whole thrust not to let people download? It seems to me that, you know, let, for instance, just before the show, I went over to eBay to look to see. There are like 5 or 10 of your albums there on vinyl, but that's not really what the younger people are looking for. So the only way they're finding your music...
It's an interesting question that you ask, and I, before my battery goes dead, I have to be honest about this, Peter. For the last 5 years, I have there was a free download site called WinMix. It was terrific. I mean, it was, you know, members only, but it was free and limited downloads. And I must have downloaded thousands of songs for nothing. And I'm being very honest. And I didn't think twice about it. I mean, and I have the best personal record collection of every song I've ever desired. And I've downloaded for nothing. I've burned my own CDs, and, you know, and I'm just, I skip around my apartment and I listen to all my favorite tracks. And at the time, it was cool. I mean, I didn't, like I said, I didn't have any misgivings about doing it myself. Now that I have my own website and that you can purchase my CDs on the website, and, of course, you know, I don't make a lot of money, but I get a percentage of the income because, you know, I get my royalties. It's handled by a mail order company, but, and you know what? I mean, just last week I got a young girl who emailed me and said she hears Let Them Dance on Sirius Radio, the disco station there, Strobe, whatever it is.
Sure, I know the station,
She wanted to know how she could purchase it. And I emailed her back and I said, well, you can either download it, the album mix on iTunes. You know, I would get paid for that, Peter. And, or I said, you can go and you can buy, if you want the 12-inch mix, you can go to my website and buy the best of D.C. LaRue, Let Them Dance. And 2 days went by, and then she emailed me back, in her naivete or whatever, in her innocence, and she said, oh, don't worry, she just had downloaded it for nothing on from LimeWire. and you know what? And in as much as I was so guilty years ago of doing that, now I have, you know, now I say, oh, boy, you know, that hurts, because, you know, if she had just downloaded it for 99 cents on iTunes, I would have made a few cents. But now I don't make anything. And it's fine. It's a double-edged sword, Peter, because, you know what, it was okay for me to do it with music I wanted, you know, over the years. But now that it comes to my music, you know, I have to stop myself from getting resentment, because I say to myself, well, if I did it, it's okay for her to do it. And all those people who are listening tonight who decide that instead of going to my website and purchasing a CD, they go to LimeWire or something, or like, I don't know, there's 4 or 5 of them, and they download it for nothing. Well, I guess God bless them. You know, it's their privilege and it's their right. And if it was good enough for me to do with other people's music, I get it's good enough for them to do with my music. I mean, what can I say? I mean, I really can't be judgmental. And it's interesting that you ask that question, because look at where I am. I'm like right in the middle. I'm like between a rock and a hard place. I mean, how would you feel if you were me?
Well, I have to agree, and I understand that was a lot of work. I mean, when you did that, you were dealing with live bands, were you not? Well, I mean, there were no music machines and drum machines, to the best of my knowledge, back in the day. That all sounded like live violin.
Music, you're right. You know, there was no synthesizers. Cathedrals is all live. It's all real musicians playing real instruments. You're right.
And so that's a huge expense right there. You were quoted at one point. I can't remember what interview or where I read this that you were on a site and you were seeing that like 300 people were downloading one song and 600 another, that in another way, you're exposing more people to your music now than ever.
Well, you're right. Where did you get that quote? I'm just wondering. Because you're right. I mean, there's the other, like I said, it's a double-edged sword. I feel a lot of the reinterest in my music is because people have been able to go to these websites. And if you go to, like, I don't know, Swing State LimeWire or something, and you try to download Cathedrals, and there are 337 people in front of you in queue waiting to download it, I could get a terrible resentment that those people are downloading it for nothing. But those are also people who are exposed to the music for the first time, and, you know, and it opens up a whole new audience for me. So I don't know. I don't know what to think. I mean, you know, it's an interesting question to ask me, let me tell you.
And I understand it. Mixed emotions. I have a question, though, about when you were working doing the album sleeves for folks like John Lennon and Bruce Springsteen and Jim Croce, Janis Ian. Did they know? Did you tell them that you were hoping to get it? Did they kind of hook you up with people that you were hoping to be a singer?
No,
that's what
I,
you
I
really.
I never mentioned it. No, I didn't wear two hats. I worked with them on their project, and then after I got finished working with them on the art direction design stuff, I would go out on my own and try to get the deal. I never asked them for any favors. I don't think it would have been worth it, actually, because, you know, but they have their egos and they're very much into what they're doing. And Janis and Ian and I are still friends. I mean, after all these years, she's living in Nashville. She's a sweetheart. And, but that being said, when I had the hit record, for example, Janis Ian was there at the parties or whatever. I mean, she was really supportive. But she didn't have a clue that I was writing music until the record was out. And I didn't feel it was my place to even talk to her about it, because when I was working for her, it was about her stuff and about her music, and it wasn't about what I was going to do with my music.
Well, I'm wondering about the track called Let Them Dance. Now, I'm not sure which album that's from, but apparently it went to gold status overnight.
What?
Is that Let Them Dance. It went to gold overnight various awards.
It was a relatively short time. I think about a week and a half, yeah. But you have to understand that was, I think that was the most commercially disco. And when it came out, it was so perfect for all the clubs. And I had two previous albums which were very successful. And people, and it was my change from Pyramid Records to Casablanca Records. And Casablanca at the time was the hottest record label, in the world. And everybody was wondering what I was going to do. And it was just a perfect record. And when it came out on Casablanca, everybody just rushed to pick it up and play it. And it was a hit. It was a real legit hit. And as a matter of fact, now we talk about Cathedrals and the reverence for Cathedrals. And right at this moment, as we speak, the record that's getting more play than anything is Let Them Dance. On internet disco radio, on satellite radio, on European radio, it's Let Them Dance. It's not Cathedrals. So it still holds up as like the big disco tune. And like Hot 97 here, the big disco dance station here. It's escaping me now. What is it? But in any case, but they play Cathedrals. They don't play Cathedrals, they play Let Them Dance. I think it's more generic, it's less introspective, and it's more typically synthesized disco. And it was a hit. It was a big hit immediately. I remember the record, I recorded the record, it was released in Los Angeles. I took a week off to go to Puerto Rico. I came back to New York City, and it had been released in New York City about 2 days. And that weekend, I went out to the club.